this is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau. Glad to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Melinda Myers is on the phone with us. She is a nationally known gardening expert, TV and radio host, author and columnist with over 30 years of horticulture experience. She's written over 20 gardening books and has lots of advice and information on her website, melindamyers.com. Hi, Melinda. Are you with us?
I am, Jill. It's always a pleasure to talk to you and your many listeners.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to have you on. And we're going to talk with you today about making the most of your garden and take your other gardening questions, of course. So join the conversation. All the lines are open, 800-642-1234. Or, you know, you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. So, Melinda, we had an awful lot of water drop on us this week, and I'm sure much of it ran straight to the ditch or the gutter. Why would it be a really good reason to save that water?
You know, there's a couple good reasons. One, personally, as a gardener, this is a great resource that's going down the drain, the storm
literally,
sewer, away from your garden. So capturing it in rain barrels or, you know, maybe even installing a rain garden helps you manage water where it falls. It also reduces the risk of flooding in your basement, overflows of storm sewer, so that can impact water quality in our waterways, our lakes, and also it means more money to process and clean our water that we end up drinking. So anytime we can capture rainwater, we get 623 gallons of water can run off a 1,000-square-foot roof in a 1-inch rainfall.
Now, oh, my gosh.
I know. So, you know, you obviously don't want to disconnect all your downspouts and change everything overnight, but maybe disconnect one downspout and put a rain barrel and consider interlinking them so you can capture more than the 50 gallons one rain barrel can collect, and then use that for your containers. Or some people will even add, you know, a hose, a drip hose, and a little bit of power, maybe solar powered, to help pump that water out and water a nearby garden. So it's a way of repurposing, keeping that water on your landscape and putting it to work.
Absolutely. Now, you had sent a link to a website, freshcoastguardians.com, for making a rain barrel, right? Some tips on adding one.
What, you bet. And how to install it as well.
And how to install it. Yeah. So for those who maybe don't have the internet or would like a few basics right now, what are some tips that you have? What do people need? That type of thing.
You bet. So when you're considering using a rain barrel, you can purchase some, and the prices have come down, and they're everything from simple faux wood rain barrels or real wooden barrels to repurposing a food-grade 50-gallon drum into a rain barrel. And we did some that we display at our We Energy Energy Park gardens, where Dawn, who's on my team and is a wonderful artist, painted them and made them beautiful, and there are tips on the Fresh Coast Guardians how to paint them, so that you can take and recycle that and make it actually a work of art in your garden. So you're going to use a barrel of sorts. Typically pick something that has a screen, or many of them have an opening just large enough for your downspout, because you're going to disconnect from your downspout to run that water into the rain barrel, or use a downspout diverter, and we'll talk about that in a minute. The screen prevents debris and bugs from getting in. You'll want to spigot lower on that rain barrel so that you don't have water stagnating in the bottom, but you can empty most of it. Elevate it, you know, on some cement blocks, or some people build nice wooden stands, and that way it's easier to access the spigot. So if you want to fill a container or run a hose from that to then water your garden or whatever. Then what I did when I lived in the city, I disconnected my garage roof and ran it to a rain barrel, and I hid it with my containers, and then I could harvest the water and use it to water all my planters.
Ah, nice.
I know. So we figured out how to hide our garbage cans.
Right.
We could figure out how to hide our rain barrels, too.
I've seen some very imaginative ways to hide rain barrels and some pictures and things I've seen online. So, yeah, use your imagination. Now,
exactly.
If that water's coming off the roof, do we have to worry about putting that water on our vegetables and eating those?
Yeah, good question. And I know there are a lot of gardeners concerned about that. Rutgers University did some research in the past few years and found that there really weren't issues in terms of food safety. But I always tell gardeners, you know, we garden and grow our own fruits and vegetables often because we want to manage what goes on those plants and for food safety and feel comfortable. So, you know, most of us have plenty of ornamental plants to water. So if you're not comfortable, you know, if you're thinking about doing it and you're a little, I'm not too sure, check out Rutgers University research. Otherwise, plenty of ornamentals that you can use that water on, and if you're feeling a little unsure about using it on your edible crops.
Yes, very good compromise. Now, another, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, exactly. We garden to really do manage our plants the way we want to do it.
Exactly. And another thing that some of us waste is garden space. So what are your suggestions for making the most out of the gardening space that we have? Because some of us have a very small space.
You know, I gardened for 26 years in the city of Milwaukee on a very tiny lot and working with lots of small space gardeners. And you're right, we want to take advantage of every, not only square foot, but square inch of space.
Yes.
So especially when we're growing vegetables, and more people are growing edibles this year, I love to do interplanting. So let's say you're planting cabbages. In between, when you put those little transplants out a foot apart, boy, there's a lot of wasted space. And what grows? Weeds.
How about, yes.
Right? How about planting some radishes? So by the time you harvest those radishes in 30 days, the cabbages are starting to fill that space, two crops out of one. Do the same with your tomatoes and peppers. You know, those little transplants are going to take time to really take off and grow. Maybe beets or leaf lettuce in between that you can harvest. So two crops out of one space. Succession or relay planting, the idea here is, okay, in spring when the temperatures are cool, we grow lettuce. We harvest that as the temperatures get hot. Maybe you put in onions or beans in its place. When those are harvested, follow up with a fall crop of radishes. So three different plantings in one row, a great way to maximize space. Wide row gardening. My dad grew up on a farm, and he always gardened in our backyard, and he'd grow a row of something, 18 inches, a row of something, 18 inches.
Yeah, my dad too.
You, right?
Yeah.
And when I moved to the city, I'm like, I don't have room for all that, you know, pathways. So I went to wide row gardening, and the idea here is you have wider rows, and you have just enough space for the plants to reach their maturity, their mature size. So my pathways would be maybe every 4 feet so that I can reach in, plant, harvest, weed, and I have cabbage to cabbage or, you know, the mature tomato to mature tomato. And I think it looks prettier too, which often, especially in small city lots, you're looking for beauty as well as productivity in every square inch versus hiding that vegetable garden in the back corner.
Right. And that's what we tend to do.
Exactly. And last but not least, go vertical. You know, training your cucumbers. I love growing climbing spinach, Malabar spinach. Not a true spinach, but it's pretty plant, edible, buttery, nutty spinach flavor. But growing them up on a trellis, then they're not crawling over the ground. Better airflow, so I have fewer disease problems. Easier to pick, pole beans in my book versus bush beans.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Uh-huh.
And so that's another way. And you might even want to put those things in a pot and train them on an obelisk or a trellis. So many options out there now, or creative DIY solutions to creating trellises for not only edibles but ornamentals. And so doing those things saves space so you can grow more and harvest more and enjoy your garden for, you know, fresh and probably have enough to preserve as well.
And that kind of leads into another thing I was going to ask. How many of us have grown so many zucchinis that they end up, you know, going bad? What are your suggestions for our harvest and how to not waste any of that?
You know, great question. I always tell people that, you know, the goal of growing a zucchini is not to have that baseball bat size,
right,
unless you're going to leave it right on your neighbor's front porch for, and I think I learned that holiday from you folks. And so what we want to do is harvest regularly, harvest those zucchinis when they're like 8 inches long, they're tender, flavorful, easy to share, and you can do some preserving pickling as well. But if you harvest regularly, you'll get the best flavor, nutritional value, and your plants will keep harvesting. Leaf lettuce, pick those outer leaves when they're 4 to 6 inches long. They'll keep producing more until it gets too hot, and then you may need to replant with a more heat-tolerant variety. For tomatoes, and I know we're all waiting, and it's going to be a while, but
yeah.
I know, nothing better. But that fully colored tomato, if you can leave them on an extra 5 days, they'll be even sweeter. But most of us are battling the chipmunks or ground squirrels or other varmints that take the bite out of one, go to the next one. And you can, right? And you can finish ripening them inside. So just getting to know your vegetables and how to harvest. And cabbage for me is one of my favorites because you have one plant, harvest the full-size head, but leave that outer ring of leaves intact, and you'll get 4 or 5 smaller heads from that plant. I know. Isn't that great?
I had no idea.
Yeah, and so you can make a lot of slaw and probably even have enough to make some kraut, too, if you have just a few plants, but you maximize the way you harvest them.
For sure. Well, great tips. Well, we do have one phone call here. If you have any questions for Melinda, we have open lines, 800-642-1234. So let's go to Harold in Birmingham. Is that correct? Hi, Harold.
Good morning. My question has to do with winter seeded native forbs, and I'm getting near a transplanting time. If I were to buy the plants from, let's say, Prairie Nursery, they would come in what are often referred to as plugs. I've been trying to find locally what the containers would be to form these plugs, and all I can find is various size pots.
Oh, so you want to purchase a plug tray to do your own, to plant your seeds in. Is that, am I understanding right?
Not the seeds, but transplant seeds are plants that are already growing from winter.
Okay. And so, I'm confused with what you want it. So you've got been growing the plants, you've got the transplants, and now what do you want to do with them?
I grew the plants. They're now 1 inch tall. It's time to replant them individually. I winter seeded gallon jugs.
Oh, and you want to put them into another size container before you put them into the garden.
Thank you for putting the right words out there.
No, I just wanted to make sure. I didn't want to give you advice, and you're like, that is not what I'm talking about, Melinda. Instead of the plugs are like 1 inch diameter, and you can get 450 per flat. And if you're planning on leaving them in those containers, you can get at most garden centers are what are called cell packs, and you might want to do the 4 or 6 cells that are interconnected. They're going to probably give you more space to grow, yet be small size, as opposed to doing individual pots. And I've been able to find those at most garden centers and even some big box stores. And so you're looking for where they have the seeds, and you'll find the flats, and then you'll find what are called cell packs. And they're just smaller, interconnected plastic containers, or some people use peat pots too, that you can do smaller size containers and then just plant them. And then some gardeners make their own from newspaper, if anybody gets newspapers in print anymore, and just roll them and make small containers that then biodegrade when you plant. And that might be an option as well. So you save kind of a step so that once they're big and ready to go in the garden, you can plant the container and all and not disrupt the roots.
Does that answer your question, Harold?
Yeah, very closely.
Okay,
yes,
super.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for the call and your patience.
Yes. we're talking about getting the most out of your garden with Melinda Myers today. Our on-air producer is Jane Rotunda, and Tyler Ditter is our technical director. Joining the conversation, there's still an open line, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. This is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. We're talking about saving water, saving space, and getting the most from your garden today. And we're also taking your questions. And Melinda, we did get an email from Ben in Minneapolis, and he said that this year he planted a row of ironwood trees and would like to plant something under and among them. He says the area gets good southern sun and the trees don't cast shade below them. He likes the idea of planting something edible, like raspberries or honeyberries. Any suggestions? Should he be concerned about whatever he plants there competing with his trees?
Yeah, that's a great question, Ben. And, you know, looking for ways to maximize space. Some nurseries are actually growing green manure crops or things that fix nitrogen, whether it's an annual cereal rye or it's a non-invasive, non-aggressive vets just to fix nitrogen, keep the weeds down, and, you know, help improve the soil so your trees have something to grow. My only concern about growing berries and things, if you don't have enough room for those plants to reach full size and the berries, and berries can be very aggressive. Those raspberries can really take off.
Yeah.
Honeyberry, right, you've obviously had the same issue I have. Honeyberries, on the other hand, are a type of Lonicera related to honeysuckle. So far, I've seen no reports of invasiveness. They produce this wonderful blueberry citrusy flavored fruit, have nice flowers in the spring. They tend to be more of a bush and less aggressive than raspberries, and they'll tolerate shade. So that might be a good addition. So as long as you leave sufficient space for your ironwood trees to grow, that would be a great option. I would just avoid anything that's overly aggressive. There are some new raspberries and blackberries that are compact. Raspberry shortcake, which is thornless, grows 2 to 3 feet tall and wide, and baby cakes, blackberries, which are about the same size and thornless. And so you could manage those plants between your larger trees. They will spread somewhat, but nothing like a regular standard raspberry or blackberry variety. So if you're looking for berries, that might be an option too, in terms of plants that will stay somewhat contained and permanent. I like that idea of permanence because you don't want to disrupt those tree roots as they grow and get settled and established. Great idea, Ben.
Yeah.
Permaculture, it's kind of where Ben's question kind of made me think of permaculture. And the idea there is really looking for ways to create landscapes that do have edibles that use the way we plant to help deal with hungry critters and pests, but keeping water and managing it where it falls. So it's looking at that whole system, you know, soils, moisture, rainfall, just like we do as gardeners, but taking it one step further. So, Ben, you might want to check out. There's lots of resources online with permaculture.
Okay, great. And as far as how far away he should plant those from the trees, what would be your suggestion?
You know, typically an ironwood, a wonderful native tree, a small-scale tree that tolerates shade, just in case anyone's looking for one like that, their spread is typically about 15 to 20 feet. So, you know, you'll want to keep them at least, you know, half of that, at least 10 feet away, just for the sunlight for those plants you're trying to grow, as well as the competition with the trees.
Okay. Yeah, because sometimes we forget that trees grow. So
exactly. Now, perennial ground covers, I forgot to mention, are great ways to manage the area under trees. You know, things like our native Canadian ginger, or I love Solomon, variegated Solomon seal, or Epimedium. Those can grow right under your tree canopy because they're going to create a nice kind of living mulch. They don't outcompete the trees for nutrients. But if you need something that needs sunshine that you're going to eat, typically, that's what we do, and something more permanent in between, then you could deal with some of those plants that we talked about.
Okay, great. Thank you. And thank you for that question, Ben. Let's go back to the phones now. We have Ruth in Glendale who has a question. Hi, Ruth.
Hi, Miranda. I have a question about my hop hornbeam. I think it's a musclewood, and it was planted about 25 years ago, and the roots sprout all over. Is there anything I can do to stop that? Trimming it is a pain in the neck.
I hear you. And a hop hornbeam or musclewood is a wonderful native tree as well, shade tolerant, those kind of things. I haven't really heard a lot of complaints on it sprouting. Not saying that that's not happening, but I'm wondering if it was grafted. Sometimes our trees are grafted onto, maybe it's a certain cultivar grafted onto a rootstock, and that's often when we see the sprouts. The best thing, and I know you've probably been doing this, is pruning those suckers as they appear, those root sprouts, and if you can cut them below ground, I have a root saw that I got from Corona that allows me to do that, because you know, when you cut into soil, you dull your pruner and your saw, and you don't want to do that with things you're going to cut branches and stems. And so those root saws work very well for that. Anything you put on that, you know, if you used a vegetation killer or brush killer, can damage the parent tree. So do not, I'm just saying this for other people that might have tuned in late, Ruth, don't do that. There are some sprout check products that I hear mixed reviews. Some people say when you treat the sprouts that it does kind of inhibit resprouting, and some say it just makes them sprout in other areas. Always read and follow label directions. I think you can find them at most garden centers or maybe online as well. So regular pruning is really your best cultural option. I'm afraid I don't have a good, simple solution for you to permanently stop this, Ruth.
Sorry about that, Ruth. No miracles today.
Yes.
Yes. Let's go on now to Joyce in Muskego. Hi, Joyce.
Hello there. First of all, thanks for your program. And second of all, Melinda, I'm sure going to miss you at State Fair this year.
Oh.
Me too. We are going to stay tuned. Check my website. I'm doing more virtual presentations, and we're thinking about some. It won't be the same as hanging out with you at State Fair, but we're working on some ways to kind of at least stay connected during that time. So I'll always check my website, and we'll have to plan for 2021, right?
Sounds good to me. Okay, thank you. My question is, I've got such a bumper crop of rhubarb this year, first year that it's really taken off so, and I usually put the leaves, which I know are toxic, as a mulch underneath the plant leaves, and today I was wondering, could I use them in the vegetable garden as a mulch?
You know, that's a great way to use some of those cast-off things from our vegetables, you know, maybe those leaves of lettuce that aren't really good, or the kale leaves that weren't worthy of being eaten. And great idea with rhubarb. The toxicity is a problem for us, not plants, and that's why we don't eat that big leaf blade. And so that's a great idea. Yes, you could use it. A friend of mine taught me a great strategy. He'd always put those kind of things in between the paths of his wide row of vegetable gardens, and then as you walk across them, it helps them break down, and so when you cover it, throw a little compost over top, they decompose and turn to compost that much quicker. So great strategy. You don't have to worry about the toxicity from a plant standpoint. It's more of a people poisoning standpoint. So great suggestion, Joyce.
Definitely, Joyce, and those leaves are so nice and big, that'll cover a lot of territory.
Exactly. I'm thinking, boy, I'm going to get busy.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, let's go to Sarah now in Milwaukee. Hi, Sarah.
Hello.
What can we help you with today?
Thanks for taking the call. And the problem that I have is I'm in Milwaukee. I have a small garden space. I've kept organic for almost 12 years.
Great.
And I have a problem with feral cats that think, you know.
Litter box, right?
Yeah, they think they love it. And I've got, in fact, one whole area I had to redo. I've got a half a dozen tomato plants in great big 5-gallon jugs because they just fouled so much of one area. And it's an area close to the house because it's nice and warm. It stays viable for the winter so they can use it. And how do I keep them away? I've tried mothballs. I've tried cayenne pepper. I've tried rosemary oil. They just don't seem to care. I don't know what to do.
You know, and that is a frustration. I'm a cat person. My cats live inside, and they look outside at all the critters and the songbirds, and they stay out of everybody's garden, including mine. There's a couple things come to mind, and I'm not sure this will work for you, but there's a product called Scat Mat, and you might be able to just kind of come up with something yourself where it's like one of those old-fashioned mats with the little rubber prongs, and it's turned upside down, so it's not going to hurt the cats, but it's going to discourage them from digging and visiting, and perhaps putting it out there in the winter especially to keep them, to kind of retrain them to find someplace else to go, one option. Some of the coarse mulches sometimes help discourage them. And usually I don't recommend wood mulch for a garden, but, you know, it sounds like you've got an established garden and you know how to grow plants. And, you know, this is not something you're going to work into the soil but put on the surface. And that often makes it less inviting for them to use as a litter box or just kind of hang out. There are some enclosures available, and I don't know if this would work in your situation, that would be almost like picture a tent but with netting that allows the light and air and water through, but mounted to the ground with a doorway for you to come in and access to keep any unwanted critters, including the cats, out. There are some, and you've probably tried, there are some repellents. You know, Plants Kid works great for a variety. It's really, cats are not on their label. It's an organic product. It's OMRI certified, and it might help you with, for sure, with rabbits and deer. I don't know about cats. I don't know that they've tested it for that. But that might be another option to give a try and see if it works. And then, you know, it's scare tactics. Feral cats are pretty hard to scare, and anything that would scare them would probably annoy your neighbors. So, you know, there are some things that use sound. There's a mini scarecrow that makes a blast and then of compressed air and then a big noise, and eventually they feel the compressed air and they run. There are sprinkler repellents, and most cats don't like water. Now, getting it low enough to get the cat, you know, putting that out, it's motion activated. So as the cat walks by, you know, hitting them with a sprinkler. I know cats are very creative, so it might be a little harder than, you know, keeping a deer away with that technique, but might be worth a try as well.
Okay, well, there's some options for you, Sarah. And if anybody out there has had good luck with keeping cats out of their garden, let us know. You can send an email to ideas@wpr.org, and we can get those sent in. I wonder myself if Sarah just borrows a friend's dog and brings the dog in occasionally, if that might help.
So. You know, and some people put the handfuls of, you know, that hair from the cat to get, or the dog, I mean, to get the smell in there. And that's a great suggestion, too. And it sounds like Sarah's, and I get it, you know, it's a very, cats are very challenging to control, even if they're your pets in the house.
Yes, they are.
Outside, even more difficult. So I like that idea of, you know, maybe your neighbor either borrowing the dog or at least having that fur when they do a brushing scattered around your garden might help as well.
Okay. Well, good luck, Sarah. We hope you come up with something.
Yes.
Let's go on to the next person. We've got Diane, and she's calling from Plymouth today. Hi, Diane.
Hi.
What can we help you with?
Hello.
Yep.
Hi,
well,
Diane.
We discovered a bumblebee in the ground in our lawn. At first I thought it was a groundhog because it was a little bigger, but then now we know it's the bumblebee. I'm just curious, like, we were thinking that, you know, we saw them kind of come out. They're not, they don't seem very aggressive. But they came out when we were walking by the other night, and it is an area we normally mow. Now, we do have a country lawn, so we're like, do you think we can just continue to mow over them, and are they going to be not too aggressive with that? What's your experience with the bumblebees?
You know, great question. Bumblebees nest often in a vacant rodent burrows. So you probably had something burrowing last year or in the past, and then the bumblebees take advantage of this. We've got some out in our, I'm out in the kind of a country lawn too, and have that same experience. You mow over and you kind of get them agitated, but then they'll follow you a while and usually don't bother you. They, you know, you, because you're moving faster and they feel like they've accomplished their goal. We got you away from our home. I had some burrowing underneath a trellis and I didn't realize, and I was weeding and I disturbed them. They got pretty mad and chased me out of my garden. I just left that area weedy, but that, you know, I had other places to garden. You know, they won, you can stay. You know, I think just monitor the results, because you can't move a bumblebee nest. We were going to do some TV shooting, and I thought, well, maybe I can move this nest. And I went on and looked at some videos and went, the bumblebees can stay. The good news is they find a new home next year. So, and that'll probably be another burrow in your yard that they'll find. At least that's what we've experienced. But we've been able to, I guess, outdistance them when we're mowing and leave them intact so they can do their job, because they're important pollinators, and bumblebees like honeybees and our other native bees are suffering decline in population. So You definitely, you'll be okay. You know, just monitor. If someone's severely allergic, this might be their way to not have to cut the grass anymore. but I find usually they just chase you away. Bumblebees are pretty docile, so just kind of monitor what's happening, because the only other thing you could do is kill them, and we don't really want to do that if we don't have to. And it sounds like you don't either, Diane. So I think just kind of keep an eye on them. Know they're out there. You know, long sleeves. If you're really worried, you might want to cover your face. But I've really not had problems as long as, you know, or if there's just one area, maybe you let that go wild for the summer and then start mowing again next year.
Okay. Thank you so much for that call, Diane. Next up is Bob in Elkhorn. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Hi, and good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What's your question?
I have a question about them paper pots. I've been experimenting with a paper pot. I have a tomato paste can, and I make about an inch high in the diameter of a tomato sauce can. Are you sure that the roots will actually grow through the summer? I mean, through the bottom of the pot?
Well, and also that when you plant it, the newspaper's going to decompose when you put it in the soil. And you've got the open bottom. So there's two ways to do it. Some people just do them with an open bottom, and then they don't put anything underneath. And I'm not sure that's how you're doing it. The other option is to then, you know, create a bottom by smashing, you know, making the, and that sounds like that's what you're doing, making that strip longer and smashing it. And just doing a single layer of newspaper. I find sometimes my pots are almost decomposed by the time I'm putting the plants into the ground as well. So I've had good experience with it. Sounds like maybe you haven't. I don't know if you're using multiple layers.
Bob, what are you using just to kind of help Melinda?
I'm using newsprint.
Just a single layer?
Yeah. A single layer
of newsprint.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. And you've had problems with the roots coming out and penetrating the soil surrounding it when you plant them in the ground? Okay.
Right.
Okay, I haven't, but you know what? We all have different experiences, so thank you for bringing that. What you could do is slice through, just like you would pea pots take a while to decompose, too. I always like to kind of remove the lip so it doesn't stick above, and I usually cut some slices through the side to help speed decomposition and allow area for those roots to go out. So that might be a solution if you're concerned that you're going to end up with that same experience as Bob. So thank you. That's what I love about what I get to do and why I like to be on public radio is I always learn something.
Absolutely. So, thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
And speaking of learning something, Kathy emailed a suggestion for keeping the feral cats out of gardens. She says she puts grass clippings down as mulch, and then over the winter, she places her wire tomato cages laying in the garden to physically prevent them from using the soil. And she also laid hardware cloth flat over parts of the soil, and the cats avoid it. Ooh, excellent ideas, Kathy.
Great. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Okay, let's go on to Judith in Milwaukee next. Hi, Judith.
Yes, I bought some sweet potatoes, and they are now growing, and I have growths of about 2 feet almost. Can I plant those and get sweet potatoes or just settle for the vine?
Oh, so you're growing the ornamental sweet potato vines.
No, this is from a regular sweet potato that I bought.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you can. There are different ways sweet potato. I wasn't sure. So thank you for clarifying. So there are several ways sweet potatoes. A lot of times they're started from slips. I purchased and bought slips of sweet potato because they're a long season crop, and so they take like 100, 110 days to mature. So that's often why they're not grown in the north. And you will get tubers roots that you can eat from your sweet potato. We typically purchase in either plants or slips because then we know they're certified disease-free. But yeah, enjoy the vine and the surprise underneath. One gardener told me they plant their sweet potatoes in 5-gallon containers or buckets or containers so that they enjoy the beauty of the vines. They don't take up a lot of garden space, and then you can just dump the bucket at the end of the season just right before a killing frost, and then harvest the tuberous roots that way.
Ooh, sounds like a fun experiment, Judith. Good luck with that. Next, let's go to Lou in Scandinavia. Hi, Lou.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. That's maybe a strange question, but I bought a small piece of property, and about 5 acres of it just covered with buckthorn. Oof. And I've noticed that the squirrels have transported some walnuts into the property and around some of those areas. Now, those walnut trees are probably about 15 years old, and it seems like some of the surrounding trees are dying. And I've heard that walnuts will kill conifer trees, but I'm wondering if walnut will kill buckthorn.
You know, that's very interesting. It sounds like, Judith, you either battled buckthorn or know people that are. Buckthorn, like black walnuts, are allelopathic, and walnuts, black walnuts more so. They contain a substance called juglone in their leaves, roots, fruits, the husk of the nuts, and all parts of the plant. And so when a sensitive plant, not only conifers, but a wide variety of vegetables, flowers, and deciduous trees and shrubs, when the roots hit maybe a root in the ground or grow into a leaf that's buried, it can wilt and some can die or be stunted. I don't think anyone's looked at the impact of juglone on buckthorn because we're trying to get rid of it. So
yes.
maybe that's one option. The problem is then finding plants if you want to put other things besides black walnut on your 5 acres. Morton Arboretum has a good list of resistant plants that tend to be resistant to juglone toxicity and those that are susceptible. I've never seen buckthorn listed on any of the variety of lists I've checked, but it makes sense. It sounds like buckthorn may be one of those sensitive. All the lists that have been put together are mainly just observational. Okay, a bunch of horticulturists have reported, okay, I've seen these plants survive near a buckthorn or a black walnut, sorry, or no, I haven't seen these plants, and so don't plant these near the black walnut. Try these instead. So very interesting. I'm going to do a little more hunting and, just making sure we don't create another problem that you're fine with having black walnuts and not much else growing around them as you try to eliminate the buckthorn. But thank you for the input. That's very interesting.
Yeah, it sure is, Lou. Thank you very much. And having had property with lots of black walnut trees, I can tell you it's just, it just depends. I've planted things that were on the list of things that didn't grow, and then they did grow. And yeah, so it is an experimental kind of thing. But you might want to think about goats, Lou. I've heard good things about goats.
Maybe that's what I need, because I'm not winning the battle in my yard.
You need a goat, Melinda. I think that would be a good idea. Melinda Myers is our guest on Garden Talk today. Why don't you join in with your questions? Call 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. This is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau, filling in for Larry Mueller today. Make sure you join us next Friday when Dr. Death, Brian Huddleston, will be back with us to talk about plant diseases. Right now, we're talking to Melinda Myers. Melinda, you had mentioned earlier that, a lot of your dates and your schedule has been certainly interrupted by this social distancing pandemic problem that we have. But you're going to be doing a virtual garden tour in July. How is that going to work?
You know, I'm so excited. They're going to do Facebook Live videos and then post them so that they, live there. So if you can't join me live, I'll be at two of the gardens that I'm so excited to share with you. So usually in the summer, there are wonderful garden tours that, support communities or gardening efforts. This one supports Pewaukee Area Arts Council. It's free to tune in. They will accept donations as well. My Facebook Live will be July 15th at 1:15 in the second garden at 2:15. But there'll be more gardens on tour with different hosts and the people that have designed and managed the gardens. The homeowners will be with me. And so it's a chance for us to walk through, videotape the garden, kind of like you're walking with me virtually through the garden. We're all getting used to this. And so it's really an exciting opportunity. And there is a link on my website to the Pewaukee Area Arts Council website with all the details on you know, where to check their Facebook page and when things are happening. And so I think, you know, we're all dying to get out and see each other's gardens. Besides missing you all at State Fair, which I get to share that garden we design and show off new varieties and gardening techniques, this is a great way that you can enjoy other people's gardens and learn more. I love garden tours because I always say you get to go in people's backyards and get to see, right?
Exactly.
And you're invited to do that. And they always have great ideas that you can use in your garden or pass along to someone else. So I'm glad you brought it up. It's a wonderful opportunity. There's some detail on my website on the gardens that I'll be leading the tour through. And then there's many other sites that they're going to be, several other sites that they're going to visit that you can join in. Again, it's free. They'll obviously accept donations, but they really wanted to share these gardens and an opportunity for you to just, you know, see what other people are doing this summer.
I just think it's a wonderful idea because you're right. We always look forward to these garden tours, and there aren't going to be any this year, more than likely. So we can enjoy with an expert, and generally we don't have that, right? We don't have a tour person. So, yeah, that'll be fun. And again, that's July 15th, right?
Right, July 15th in the afternoon for the live presentation, and then it'll live on their Facebook page as well, so you can check it out later.
Yeah, and you can get more information about that at Melinda's website, which is Melinda Myers, MYERS.com. So all kinds of good stuff on that website, by the way. I enjoy checking it out occasionally.
Thank you.
Yeah, let's go back to the phones. We have Paul in Poinette. Hi, Paul, you there?
I am.
What's your question or comment?
Just a comment in reply to the question about black walnut taking out or destroying buckthorn. I would say that would not work. We have buckthorn that thrives under our black walnut trees.
Oh, drat.
There you go.
So, that's all I got.
Well, thanks for that bad news, Paul.
Thank you. And and you know what? Then you have the black walnut and another issue. So probably good to stop that right now. So, okay, on to the goats, I guess.
On to the goats. Thanks, Paul. All right, well, let's go on to Janice, and she's in Antioch, Illinois, or Antioch. Hi, Janice.
Hi. I'm in the same vein, though, this using the black walnut as a preventative of some sort. I have a huge, long, about 80 feet at least, and two cars wide, and then it bends around and turn into the the garage door. And I have to spend most of my summer bent over with my fanny in the air pulling weeds.
Oh.
And could I grind up those stems and those multiple leaves that I rake up every fall to keep them out of my flower beds and spread them on my driveway? And little, would that help prevent the weeds from coming up, you think?
So taking the black walnut droppings, is that what you're saying, and then putting it over that area to keep the weeds down?
Well, to prevent them from germinating.
You know, any kind
of, I'm tired of spraying.
Oh, I don't blame you. Any kind of mulch is going to help reduce weed sprouting, and the benefit of using shredded bark or wood chips, anything that's not black walnut, if you ever decide to plant something in that area, you know, you could have good plants growing in that area and help suppress annual weeds. You know, any mulch is not necessarily going to kill the bad weeds. And black walnut doesn't kill everything, but any mulch that you put down can help suppress weeds. It won't prevent everything, but you'll really have fewer weeds sprouting and coming through the area. I'm a big believer if you have fall leaves on your property, shred them up with your mower and throw them on that area. You'll be amazed after you weed it. Or throw that newspaper, a couple layers of newspaper down, and then cover it with mulch. I had an area where the house I live in now came with some spruce trees. They were individually planted, so I mowed the grass and weeds really short, edged the bed so the surrounding grass couldn't support the grass inside that future bed. And then I mowed that really short, put cardboard over top and wood chips. And I did not have a weed issue, and I'm just starting to see weeds coming through 7 years later. So I really have had great success using cardboard over, really cut the weeds really short, edge that area, and you could just use a shovel to do that, or get some help from somebody, and then cover it with wood chips, and you'll be amazed. You'll take care of those weed problems, and it'll be a lot easier that way.
Of course, it is on her driveway, though, her gravel driveway, so that might...
Oh, is that? Okay,
yeah.
I didn't understand the driveway portion.
Yeah, I think that got missed a little bit in the translation,
okay.
But yeah, it is a long gravel driveway.
Thank you. The thing you may want to do, that's coming back in popularity, sorry, really went the wrong direction.
No, that's
there,
a, someone else probably had that same question, though, Linda,
okay.
So we're good.
Okay, so we helped them. Quarantine
yes.
Fog, I'm blaming it on. So for gravel driveways... I have one too. One of the things that's really come back in vogue is using propane weeders. And they have directed flames. You want to keep it away from buildings, but using that to kill those weeds. Products that use plant oils or also soap, fatty acids of soap, but at a stronger level will burn the tops off, so you don't have to do the weeding as well. And so if you put plant debris on your gravel driveway, you're creating a better environment for more weed seeds to grow and sprout. So you don't want to do that. And I think trying either look for a propane weed killer or try some of those organic products will help reduce that need to bend over and pull those weeds, which I find difficult to manage and pull in a gravel driveway.
Yes.
And sorry for the confusion, Janice.
Okay. Well, hopefully that'll help, Janice, and good luck with that. If anybody else has any ideas about that, please email us again. It's ideas@WPR.org. Let's go back to the phone, and we've got Chris in Heartland with a question. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Melinda.
Hi, Chris.
I have a newer, well, I planted them last year, two hydrangeas, and I just noticed that the deer are munching them this year. They left them alone last year, but they're munching them this year. Is there something I can spray that, or put on or near that will keep them away from those hydrangeas?
You bet. I'd mentioned plant skid earlier, and it's one that has proven very effective on deer. It's organic. It's OMRI, the first one to be OMRI certified, which is Organic Materials Research List, and it's proven very effective. It's organic. Somebody called a couple weeks ago and asking if there was a problem with too much nitrogen, because it does contain nitrogen, but it's such a low level and slow released, it's not going to stimulate leaf and stem growth over flowering, no matter what you put it on or around. There are liquid and granular formulations, and you might want to try that. I had met one guy in Ohio when I was speaking that said he puts wine bottles, you know, pretty colored ones, on rebar so they kind of clang in the wind, and that helped keep the deer away. I think it's a lot of what they're used to. You know, animals get used to certain sounds, scare tactics, and they'll work for a while. You know, at least his solution was somewhat decorative, he said, so he was happy with that. So you might want to try the plant skid. I am working with them because I like the product. I've had great success using it in my gardens as well.
So how do you spell that, Melinda? Plant?
It's plant, PlantSkydd.
Okay.
It's out of Sweden originally, so that's the interesting spelling.
Oh, okay. Okay, great. Well, I'm glad I asked you to spell it because we'd probably everybody be looking for SKID. So.
Exactly. Yeah. You're wondering, that doesn't make sense. So.
Absolutely. All right. Well, good luck, Chris. Let's go on to Whitney in Verona. Hi, Whitney.
Hi. I have a question. This year I purchased some chopped straw, and it said it was for garden beds, and so I spread it in every single one of my vegetable and flower beds, and now it's growing like grass.
Oh.
So it's eating with everything, and I looked it up, and I said you could cut it, which I've tried, but it's just like taking it over. So I'm not sure. Do I start over? What do you suggest?
I've used this product too with the same bad results. So I feel your pain. A couple things you may want to do. I've just purchased a Dutch hoe. I always used an action hoe, which had like a little stirrups, you know, very sharp edges, and you go back and forth, or called a shuttle hoe. The Dutch hoe has kind of a triangular blade that you can use. And I've been trying that under my mulch because I use a lot of mulch, but occasionally weeds come through at such a level because the mulch needed to be replenished before I did. And in this case, it might work around your plants. You want to be careful not to damage the roots, but keeping it away from the main plant and then hand pulling those might be an option. Again, if you want to be organic, you could try using some of the organic grass and weed killers, which use the soap or plant oils. They'll burn off the top, and since these are young seedlings, you should have good control. You could put like a milk jug over your plants to protect them so you don't damage them. And once these products hit the soil, it's not a problem. They just burn the leaf tissue and stem tissue. And that might be a way to avoid starting over from scratch, but yet using something safe and organic in your garden.
Thank you so much for that call, Whitney. So you're saying maybe chopped straw isn't a great idea because there may be weed seeds in it?
Yeah, either weed seeds or there might be the seeds from the straw plants. You know, it's always challenging. And I did like the chop better because I could mound it thicker and kind of block the light and prevent other seeds from sprouting. But that's why, you know, free stuff like your leaves if you have them. Evergreen needles don't make our soil too acidic. We wished it would in some parts of the state.
Yeah.
But they're wonderful mulch. And some people purchase twice shredded bark and things. I like to keep those for perennials, trees and shrubs, any of the wood products.
Sure, that makes total sense. We've been talking about getting the most out of your garden with nationally known gardening expert Melinda Myers. I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm in for Larry Mueller today. Remember, you can hear us Friday at 11, Saturday morning at 6, or online anytime. Stay with us. There's always more to come. This is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau in for Larry Mueller today. Glad to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Melinda Myers is back with us. She's a nationally known gardening expert, TV and radio host, author, and columnist. What gardening questions on your mind? What's your garden doing like this year? It's been doing well? Let us know. We'd like to hear from you. We are having a little bit of a problem with our phones again, and we apologize. Everybody's working from home these days, so it's making it more difficult for everyone. But you can try calling 800-642-1234. But why don't you just send us an email if you have access to that? It's ideas@wpr.org. So ideas@wpr.org. So, Melinda, you still with us?
I am. Luckily, my phone line's working so far.
Excellent. Excellent. Yeah, you know, every day is a little bit different. So.
I bet. We're all adapting.
Yes, we are. We're doing the best that we can. But we do have a couple of emails that we can talk about. The first one was from Robin. And Robin said that they have a white ash in their backyard. Typically, they save the leaves and use them for mulch in the garden. If they treat the tree with an injection by an arborist, is it okay to use the leaves from the tree mulch? They have a lot of native pollinator plants in the yard.
That's a really good question. So the product is absorbed. I'm walking through the process, Robin,
sure,
here, kind of working it out while you're listening. Is absorbed through the roots, goes through the trunk. Where we worry about our pollinators is when it concentrates in the flowers and the pollen. They found what happened is what we thought was not a problem concentrated in the pollen, and then the bees were taking it back to their hives. And that's why, you know, we're really concerned about growing those plants. And even with ashes, they're wind pollinated, but they have seen some issues. And that's why arborists are being very careful in their timing of application. I have not seen anything that would make me think it's not an issue. If you are concerned, you may want to use it around trees and shrubs. You may want to compost it first because that's where a lot of those chemicals, once it's fully decomposed, would break down. I honestly have not seen anything. You know what? I'm going to do a little hunting, Robin. You've stumped me, and I don't know if PJ Leash, the UW Extension insect diagnostic director is going to be on soon that might know and have some idea of how that product breaks down.
We have Phil on next Wednesday, Phil Pelletieri.
Oh, perfect. So. I'm gonna pass that on to Phil.
That's
so
okay.
Robin, yeah. Listen in on Wednesday, and I will too.
Okay, sounds good. And then we also have an email from Julie. She has a 20-year-old pink peony plant that is looking poorly, but it has been fabulous for years. It set buds this spring, but only 10 of them bloomed, and the rest are tiny and hard and dry. Is it a root issue? Should she cut it down and dig it out? Any other thoughts?
Yeah, peonies can live. I've seen peonies that have been in the same location for 100 years, still growing flower, and they are such tough plants. So the good news is, Julie, leave your peony intact. It sounds like you may have botrytis blight, and botrytis blight is a fungal disease that often attacks roses and peonies. And if it attacks when the flowers are in bud, they often turn brown and fail to open. And so it's more of a disease issue on the surface, above ground portions, than in the root system. In the fall, do a good cleanup. If the weather is dry next year, not as rainy, you won't see the problem. I usually typically see this and Phytophthora, which causes kind of purpley blotches on the stem and leaves, and botrytis can do the same in brown blotches. I typically see it happen for a few years in a row. We get some wet springs. We don't get everything out of the garden in fall, so the disease overwinters, and it just keeps continuing. And then we get a little bit drier spring, we get a little bit better fall cleanup, and it usually resolves itself. There are fungicides you can apply, including organic ones, but you need to really do it before the problem occurs. So just make a note on your calendar next year, you know, if it's a wet spring they're predicting and you've had this problem several years in a row. But I usually find sanitation, good cleanup in the fall, keeps it under control. So unfortunately bad this year, but the good news is it won't kill your plant and you don't have to move it if you don't want to.
And moving peony is a little tricky, isn't it?
You bet. So one of the things, we typically like to do it in the fall because we're going to move, dig up the rhizomes, and we're going to replant those with the bud, the growth point about 1 to 2 inches below the soil surface. Planting too deep can reduce or prevent flowering in the future, though kind of like you were saying before, you break the rules and it all goes well. I had somebody bury theirs. They didn't want it with soil to redo the bed, and it came up and bloomed for them 18 inches of soil later.
Oh, my gosh.
I know. So who'd have thought? And so that's one thing. It delays it by a year, so if you transplant them this fall, you may not get blooms next spring, but you should the following year. And then just avoid too much nitrogen fertilizer or excess shade that can prevent bloom. So you need to live with it this year. Hopefully we won't, you know, hopefully the leaves will look good for you throughout the summer so they add that beauty to the garden. And then next spring will be a little bit drier. We just had a typical Wisconsin crazy spring, wet, cold snap a little bit later in the season than we expected, and just the normal changes 5 minutes, what are you going to do kind of weather.
That's right. Be prepared for anything.
Exactly.
Okay, we've got an email from Mike, and he's from Dallas, Wisconsin. He has 4 to 5 outdoor cats he keeps out of his large garden with a fence. It's only 3 foot high, but it's enough. They don't jump over just to use the bathroom. He also chases them out if they get in, but usually that's because they snuck through the door he has. They typically won't jump over the fence like a deer. That's interesting.
Well, thank you, Mike. And one of the things, since we're talking fencing, and you mentioned the cat sneaking in through the gate.
Yeah.
When you're fencing for wildlife, as well as feral cats, not only is height an issue, but it's tight to the ground. You know, if you're trying to keep rabbits out, they can really squeeze under if it's not secure to the ground. So if you can't even bury that bottom inch or two to keep out, you know, 4 to 6 inches to keep out voles and baby rabbits and secure. And then your gate, that's really where a lot of wildlife gets through. I had a woman one time bring us some pictures and samples, and I said, well, that's rabbit damage because I have a fence. And I'm like, well, are they getting in? No, no, they're not. And she called me later and said, there's a fat rabbit living happily inside my garden.
Oh, no.
So, you know, and it's easy to do because it's hard to secure that gate, make it easy for you to get in and out, but hard for them. Mm-hmm. So I really appreciate that, Mike. Thank you so much for sharing that advice. And there are cat fences that some people use because they want to let their cats out, but keep them safe from wildlife or contained and out of other people's yards. So there are some cat fences that use kind of like deer fencing and almost total enclosures too. So people that may be wanting to do what Mike is doing, leaving the cats outdoors, but keeping them somewhat contained, there are some of those enclosures available too.
Sure. And he did add that for his flowers along the house, he uses those cat track things with the pokers, and they stay away from where he has those, but they're pretty expensive. So it's not something you could do all over the garden. So
thank you, Mike. I love when gardeners share what's working for them.
Yeah.
Thanks,
isn't that
so
great?
Much.
Yeah. And just to let everybody know who's been trying to get in, we are having a phone breakdown. Excuse me. So it's my voice apparently. So we won't be able to take any more calls the rest of the day, but our email is working just fine. So you can email us, and the email is ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. But this gives me a little more time to chat with you, Melinda. One of the things we wanted to talk about, you know, is sustaining the garden, making more of what we have. And I think we've all been to that problem where we've got these beautiful flowers going on and then they're gone. Are there some ways to keep those flowers going for more than a week or two?
And you know, isn't that true? This spring was nice and cool. So if you were growing bulbs, it was a great year.
It was.
Wasn't it? My daffodils lasted so long. But then the hot weather came and the late bloomers were gone, right?
Yeah.
And so one of the things I love to do, I plant my bulbs among my perennials so that I'm kind of lazy. I want to say low input, busy gardener, not lazy.
I like that.
But, you know, we got all those daffodil leaves, not the most attractive, but we need to leave them intact so that they put energy back in the bulbs for next year. So I like to put perennials, so my perennials start coming up and masking the leaves. And then we have the spring perennials that kind of fade, or maybe you put in pansies, though I'll tell you, my pansies are still doing pretty good.
Really?
I know. They're just starting to fade right now, and I planted for a video we did, and I'm like, okay, Di, I've got things I want to replace you with, but I don't. They look so too good, so they're starting to fade. So kind of think of it like we talked about vegetables. So maybe you have your spring blooms, like your pansies that like it cool. Can you interplant with something that's going to then take over your zinnias or your marigolds, or just even remove your pansies? Or I like to plant pansies in my fall garden, do some of those cool wave pansies that tolerate the winter. So I plant them in the fall, enjoy their beauty, and then next spring they're up. And when the warm weather arrives, I can replace those with some summer annuals to fill in those areas, or interplant them with your perennial so they fill that early space, and as your perennials grow, they crowd them out and mask those declining pansies as well. Deadheading. I'm not a big person that likes to do a lot of deadheading, so you may want to look for plants that are self-cleaning. Impatience, and Beacon Impatience is a new downy mildew resistant variety of impatience. So if you love impatience but had problems with that disease, check out Beacon, B-E-A-C-O-N, Impatience. And those are self-cleaning, so they drop their petals. And so maybe keeping them away from the edge of the patio so you don't have the debris of the petals, you know, that bothers some people. I just sweep things away.
Yep.
I'm a little tolerant of that. But those self-cleaning things need less deadheading. But let's say you're growing salvia. First flush of blooms, mine are blooming right now. They're in full bloom. They look great. As that first flush blooms, if you deadhead, remove that down to the side branches, the second flush of flowers are really going to be larger and showier. When they're done, cut them back if your plants tend to flop, and that's going to then encourage new growth. Some will rebloom, like Sunny Border. Or that's a Veronica, but some will kind of rebloom possibly, but at least look better in the garden for you. And then a lot of garden centers now sell annuals, large size annuals, midsummer. And so popping in some when things are starting to look bad, pop in some fresh new plants in the middle of the summer to fill in any voids that maybe your design didn't quite work out as you planned.
And that can happen.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And so that's another way to do it. But deadheading, you know, is a little putsy, but the payoff is big. And especially if you only have a few plants you're deadheading and the rest are, you know, self self-cleaning and you don't need to deadhead. So you can go, okay, I like this plant enough that I'm going out and deadheading it, and the rest are going to take care and cover that for me. And then again, take notes. You know, there are certain times of the year in my garden too, I find, oh man, you know, between the early spring bloomers and the mid to late summer bloomers, it's always a hard time in my garden. And so I like to visit botanic gardens, other people's garden, take a walk around your neighborhood, you know, places where you can observe, oh, I like that plant, and it's in full bloom, and it would look great in my garden right now, and fill that area that's in need of some color as well.
Well, that's a great idea. And I know that if you don't know what that plant is, there are some really good phone apps, aren't they, that can help you figure
you
out
bet.
What it is. Yeah.
You bet.
Yeah.
And the other thing is gardeners always love to share. Now, we need to be social distancing and safe, and you may not be comfortable knocking on their door. Just since we have a little time, I did a garden tour years ago in the Netherlands and took the group on a tour, and there was a plant I didn't know. So this guy's walking out. I asked what it was, and he didn't know. He brought his mom, who didn't speak English, out. She didn't know what it was. Got the neighbor. Pretty soon we had like 8 people. My daughter was in middle school at the time, dying of embarrassment. You know,
of course.
I can't go to a foreign country with my mother without being embarrassed. But we got the name of the plant. And those people probably had this great story to tell about this group of Americans walking
sure.
down the street
yeah.
asking for help.
I love it.
And
I love
so,
it.
So, you know, and gardeners love to share.
They
and
do.
So,
they do.
You know, I think gardening, since we are in these times and more people are gardening, I hope we can keep those newbies going. So I know a lot of your listeners are very experienced gardeners, and our job is to help those newbies find the joy we know and keep them growing in years
yes.
to come.
Very well said, Melinda. We do have a couple of emails we can get to now.
Excellent.
We have another Robin emailed that the blossoms on their lilac bush started dying as soon as they started to blossom. The bottom part starts drying as the top is opening. It's a light lilac color, if that matters. Their neighbors, who's this darker blossoms for months. Any thoughts?
Okay, if it's just the blossoms, that a couple things. Monitoring the weather, we've had some, you know, it's, again, I'm blaming the weather.
Yes.
But we did have some late cold snaps that, depending on the development of your lilac flowers versus your neighbors, could impact their ability to grow and reach maturity, could have caused damage. It sounds like if the plant is looking healthy, that's a good thing. That makes me feel like it's just maybe weather-related. We had a lot of rain early. It's been dry recently, and drier conditions often show up by poor flowering. And again, depending on your soil, I have sandy soil, so it dries faster. Those of you with clay, the moisture holds longer. If the leaves are distorted or drying up as well, then you might want to look for borer, indication of borer scale insects. Borers drill holes into the base of the stem, feed, blocking the flow of water and nutrients. But you typically see more than the flowers going. You typically see some leaf dieback. Bacterial blight can cause the leaves to curl, almost look like they've been sprayed with a broadleaf weed killer. And again, you'd see the impact on the leaves, not just the flowers. So if it's just the flowers, then I'm going to blame the weather. And then watch your soil moisture as well. And then just monitor the plant health in general to make sure no other symptoms show up on the leaves or the stems of the plant.
Now, she was a little concerned that her neighbors is fine and they blossom for months, but that just is a different species of lilac, right? Variation.
Exactly. Different species and also location. I know it's hard to believe that your neighbor's growing conditions can
yeah.
be that much more different. You know, when I lived in the city, I would find great variability in my small landscape on the north side versus the side between my neighbor's house and mine and the exposed west side because I had a park across the street, so the winds would whip through. Very, very protected on the east exposure by my brick garage, my neighbor's brick house, and my brick house. And so there are two things. Like you said, Jill, the neighbors could be different. It could have been at a different stage of development if a cold snap happened. It could be in a more sheltered, and it could be a different variety. Some bloom earlier, some bloom a little later than others as well. So it just may be that unique situation in your yard or the variety you're growing.
Okay, great. Thank you. Joanne emailed that she's worried about her peppers in these colder temps that we're supposed to be expecting tonight. Should she cover those up? It's only going to get down to 46, but...
Yeah, no, and it's a great question, Joanne, because tomatoes and peppers can tolerate those cooler temperatures, but it does stunt them. And sometimes on tomatoes as well, we will see some brown spots develop. Almost looks diseased, but it's really a response to the weather. One of the things I love to do with my peppers and my tomatoes is I like to cover them at planting with floating row cover. It's spun fabric that lets air, light, and water through but traps the heat around them. And even though we don't get freezing temperatures in June, we often have cool nights like this in the 40s, and that can slow things down. So by keeping them covered early in the season, it speeds growth. You'll be a shorter time to harvest, and you'll have less stunting due to those cooler night temperatures. So for people that are like, I'm not covering my plants, they will be okay. For Joanne, who's willing to do a little extra effort, or anybody that has the time or the ability to get them covered, it's just going to give them that little nudge and give them that extra protection that will maybe speed things up for your first harvest of peppers and tomatoes.
Yes, good luck, Joanne. We've had plenty of gardeners calling us and saying that they love those floating row covers, and they use them a lot. So,
great, and they don't require construction, which I love. And they're reusable until they rip to shreds. I keep cutting mine smaller, so glad to hear others are.
And you can just get those pretty much all over where there's gardening things, right? Pretty
you
easy.
Bet. Mm-hmm. You bet. Okay. And they're available online or at gardens. Most garden centers and even, you know, hardware stores.
Sure. Let's just talk real quick here. Larry in Burlington, he says his tomato plants are looking great, but they're already blossoming. And is it appropriate to cut off the early blossoms or just let them go? What are your thoughts on that?
You know, when we plant, we definitely want to pop up those early flowers. I have a couple peppers doing the same thing, and it's so hard to do because we're like, oh, we can speed it up. But if your plants have only been in for a couple of weeks, the benefit of removing those flowers, as he knows, obviously he's asking, is then that allows the plants to really develop a good, strong root system. And then they're going to flower and fruit, and they'll be more productive. If you've ever let a pepper with, you know, a scrawny transplant, can you tell? I did this for research. in my garden with a few flowers that I maybe missed, and it had peppers, but, boy, only a few. So sacrificing early is going to pay off in the long run.
It's hard to do, though, isn't it? It's a really hard thing to do.
You know, and with flowers, you know, with annuals, too, they're in bloom when we buy them because the garden centers and growers know we're going to pick them up if they're looking beautiful.
Yes.
And if we remove those flowers, they'll put the energy into rooting, we'll get more. So what I sometimes do is remove the flowers on every other plant initially. And then as the first batch that I, you know, remove those flowers start to get established, then I remove them on the second batch so that I have a few flowers to get me through until the plants really start producing. If I can't just remove them all at planting.
Right. Okay, so in the last 30 seconds, we've got a question from Kurt in Poignet. He did a soil test, and it showed that his kitchen garden is low in potassium. He burns hardwoods in the winter for heat. Can he add those wood ashes to help raise that?
You know, wood ash does have potassium in it. It does tend to make the soils more alkaline. Your soil, I think in Poignet, check your soil test, is probably on the acidic side. The only problem is going to be knowing how much is enough to add. So you might want to take your soil test results, send it to your call your local extension service, or I don't know if the soil testing lab will respond to you about how much to add. But I would get a little more detail on how much potassium in that wood ash before counting on it to make the difference.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the question, Kurt. And Melinda, thank you again for being with us. Always such a pleasure.
Thank you, Jill. It's always fun, and good luck to everybody out there growing.
Yeah.
We will all see each other in person sooner rather than later.
Fingers crossed. Our guest today on Garden Talk has been Melinda Myers. She's a nationally known gardening expert, and you can find more about her at melindamyers.com. Join us Monday when we talk about getting fit for outdoor sports with our physical therapist. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks so much for listening to the Ideas Network. Stay well and enjoy your weekend.